Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios Oceanside and FYP Studios West. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 83 of Registry Matters. Larry, how the hell are you?
Well, it could be better, but I'm here.
You could probably be worse, too. You are like 300 years old, so we can't expect too much.
That is true. The age that I am is an age that few will ever see.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. We have a few people joining us in chat, which is exciting. We have a new person. Oh, we actually, I'll have to go get the information, but we have a couple of new patrons. One of them is Charles. You don't happen to remember who the other one was. I'm running on reserve energy here. I'm traveling, but I sent the message to you.
Well, I can discover it very shortly, but I do not remember. You know my memory. How would you expect a 300-year-old person to remember?
I know, right? Well, that's a pretty high expectation for you, right?
So now if it happened 200 years ago, I can remember it. It's just when it's recent that I can't remember it.
It is Carl. How about that?
So
we have two new patrons. We have Charles and Carl. And I can't thank you guys enough, and also thank you to all of our patrons. Thank you. Thank you. It makes it so awesome to do this podcast, knowing that people support us like this.
Sure does. Thank you, everyone.
Well, we just really need to dive into this because this is a very special, like, you know, I'm coming out of hiding. I'm traveling. I'm on the road. And because of the most importantly, this Tennessee thing just like bubbled up out of nowhere. And so we got to run the news sounder and we got to talk about this just briefly before we get into the show. What's going on in Tennessee, Larry?
Well, the Tennessee legislature passed Senate Bill 425, which will do enormous damage if it's allowed to become effective. And there's a temporary restraining order issued yesterday. So that is truly late-breaking news, and we'll talk about it more as we get toward the end of the program.
This is horrific, though, isn't it?
Oh, it would be horrific if it were allowed to go into effect.
One of our listeners, Will, who phones in a lot, he is... He's kind of all over this, sending messages and finding out a whole bunch of information. But yeah, so we'll cover that here in just a couple minutes. Tell us what's going on in the what's going on with the Supreme Court decision about the child pornography.
Well, that was another fantastic win. And I first had opined privately in conversation that it was less related to sex offenders, and it was more related to due process for people of supervised release. But upon a cursory glance, which I still haven't read the opinion, it is very much about those convicted of child porn possession, because the Supreme Court has clarified that the jurisdiction to extend the sentence by revoking supervised release, giving people more time than what they had originally. Those facts have to be determined by a jury. So this is a fantastic decision. I'm hoping I can read it over the coming week and be more informed next week. But it was USA versus Haymond, and unfortunately, it was not a unanimous decision. Most of the conservatives abandoned, but at least a couple of them did join with the liberals, and we got a great decision. That the United States Supreme Court, it says, I highlight just a few things in the syllabus. Mr. Haymond faced a lawful prison term between 0 and 10 years, but just like the facts the judge found at the defendant's sentencing in Aileen, the judge found here increased the legally prescribed range of allowable sentences in violation of the Fifth and Sixth Amendment. That's on page 2. And then it says a mandatory 5-year sentence comes into play as a result of additional judicial findings that they're only found by preponderance of the evidence, and that cannot stand because the evidence in a supervised release, the standard of evidence is only preponderance rather than beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's just fantastic news that people will not end up being incarcerated on a preponderance of the evidence standard for a sentence greater than what they had originally.
Didn't we cover something about this maybe 2 months ago? This sounds incredibly familiar. So someone in this case is they're on supervised release, and then they have is this an actual new crime, or is this a probation violation? And they have given them extra time beyond what their sentence was. This sounds so familiar to me.
Well, it can be both. I mean, the possession of images can be a new crime, depending on which images you're possessing. On this case, he was revoked for violation of supervised release. And there's a special section that applies when a defendant commits this infraction, and it requires a mandatory 5 years, which was not see, 0 to 10 was the option at the beginning, and he got 38 months. And then by violating his conditions of post-prison supervision, he gets a 5-year mandatory minimum.
Right.
And that was, and that's on a much lower standard of evidence, a burden of proof. So the Supreme Court said that cannot stand.
Remind me what burden of proof is. Is that just 50 plus one?
Well, it depends on, there's various levels. Of course, the beyond a reasonable doubt is the most significant one, but you have all these lesser burdens by clear and convincing, by preponderance, reasonable articulable suspicion, probable cause, but this is preponderance of evidence is slightly more than 50%. If you've got a scale balancing that evidence, it tips the scale slightly in favor of one side versus the other.
I just feel that we had this situation come up before where someone got charged past what their original sentence would have allowed for. And I'm just trying to clarify if we've covered this. Is this something being regurgitated that SCOTUS finally saw, or is this something completely new?
I think we've danced around this issue before. It'll continue to resurface because the apparatus wants to continue to impose more time on people than what they really had available to them to start with. And I really like the part of the syllabus I highlighted that section 3583K limits the judge's discretion in a particular matter by imposing a mandatory minimum term of imprisonment of not less than 5 years upon a judge's finding the defendant has committed. And a judge's finding, like I say, is by preponderance of the evidence. And this is just great news. Even out of a relatively conservative Supreme Court, there were some justices that saw it the correct way, in my opinion.
Right. If I recall, I was reading through some of the comments on this particular case. And I'm surprised whenever I see positive comments surrounding our issue. And it seemed that, I mean, I read through 20 or 30 comments. I didn't see anybody say, throw them under the bus, they should die. Everyone was saying, it looks like they got it right in this case. You can't have someone get sentenced past the amount of their time. If the person had, if it was something of a probation violation, then all they could do is max them out, but they can't give them time past what their sentence would have been. All the comments that I saw from people were supporting what the judges had decided.
Well, I think they got it right, of course, but some of the justices didn't think they got it right, and they dissented. So Alito filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Roberts and Thomas and Kavanaugh.
And do we want to call colors balls and, or what is it, balls and strikes, stripes and solids? Who was on our team and who was not on our team?
Well, it's one of those things where there's never a predictive model that you can be certain on. As a general rule, the more liberal judges are going to be on the side of the accused when it comes to due process. That's a general rule. In this case, we had them joined by a couple of conservatives. But you can never predict these things. Scalia, the late Scalia, was due process. You didn't have a stronger judge who believed in due process than Scalia. So I hate to politicize it, but if I were a betting person when I tell people, I don't have any politician I agree with, anybody I agree with all the time. If I'm going to align myself, I'm going to align myself with people I agree with more of the time than not. And I would rather criminal matters be decided by the more liberal side of the bench as a general rule, but not always, but as a general rule, yes.
I gotcha. And so who then pushed it over? If the four liberals voted, then who was it that sided with us to make it 5-4?
Well, it says, of course, it should announce the judgment of the court and delivered an opinion in which Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined. Breyer filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. Alito filed a dissenting opinion in which Roberts, Thomas, and Kavanaugh joined.
Gotcha. So Kavanaugh sided, or some, not Kavanaugh, Gorsuch sided with us, it seems. I want to say again, and I know you can't predict it. I understand that, and these shouldn't be politicized that way, but it does seem that you have Team Blue and Team Red, and Team Blue generally goes in our favor. And here we had Gorsuch switch hitting and coming to our side.
And we've had Kavanaugh.
Yes.
And I tell people, I think they've heard, longtime listeners have heard me talk about Judge John Paul Stevens was a scary figure when he was replacing the late, now late Justice William O. Douglas. And Stevens turned out to be a very good justice. So we just don't know what these newest justices will evolve into. We just don't.
Gotcha. Well, let's move on over to, last week, I guess it was, we covered an article out of South Florida where they were reducing the amount of exclusion zones that people had to worry about. And it was going from like 2,000 to 1,400 feet or something like that. And it opened up 15% of the county for people to live. Here's an article from the West Volusia Beacon, and it is DeBerry tentatively okays tougher sex offender law. This is moving. The city council currently requires 1,000-foot separation between homes, schools, parks, and where registrants live. And now they're going to make it, it looks like it says 2,500, and that's from boundary to boundary. I guess that means like property corner to property corner. That is a huge increase in restriction zones.
It'd be interesting to see what the effect of it will be in terms of the amount of parcels that'll be available after the restriction takes effect. This is why it's so critical to preempt these localities from doing these. It becomes a competition, and we took the initiative to pass this into state law in 2013, where we preempted the locals from having any part of authority to do this type of regulatory intervention. And it's as far as I know, we're the only state who passed it in statute. I think there's other states that may have had it in statute from the get-go, maybe one or two others, and then there's been judicial decisions that have said that they're preempted by the state constitutions and by other reasons that they can't do it. But this is a battle you can't win, because these counselors are responding to the fears of their constituents, and they're not hearing anything from the other viewpoint. They're just hearing that, keep my kids safe, and that's what they're going to do.
Is Florida having the ability to do this similar to that case in Texas from around 2015, where they were smaller than such and such size, so they weren't allowed to be responsible for their own actions? I don't remember the right way to word it. Is this vaguely similar to that?
Well, I don't think there's a home rule. I haven't heard the home rule issue there, but that was a case in Texas where the smaller cities of less than 5,000 did not have the authority to regulate sexual offenders, but the larger cities did, and the court ruled on a challenge that you're correct, the home rule cities can't do this. Some had done it, and as I've said many times, you can do it until you're stopped. So the people that had the towns that had the smaller populations passed the ordinances, and they were challenged, and the challenge prevailed, and of course then they went to the legislature and they argued for the authority to regulate sex offenders, and it was very difficult to say, well, I mean, we have this great authority that we get to our larger cities, but since you're small, you're not smart enough and sophisticated enough. So, of course, the legislature passed giving the small towns the authority. Well, that's the opposite direction where you're wanting to go. The direction you want to go is, do you want to preempt from locals doing that? Because then you don't have the competition. Then you only have to worry about state law. Now, that's enough to worry about, because the state law can be increased, but you don't want competition between cities trying to drive the offenders out of their territory.
So not in my backyard, but eventually there's no backyards left and they end up living under bridges, and then they get evicted from there and they're just stuck wandering, and then they get arrested.
Then we get to spend a whole bunch of money all over again.
And you keep saying competition, so that this county says, here, we're going to go 2,500 feet. Then another county says, well, we have to go 2,500 feet. They did it. And then it just spirals out of control and goes around the whole state.
That is correct. As we get into the main event, we'll hear a little bit more about the reaction. Tennessee was partially driven by the law in Alabama, but what you have is look at Metro Atlanta. You look at all these small communities that are in the suburbs that are not in the city limits. And so if you looked at Conyers and Covington and Riverdale and Sandy Springs and Dunwoody and Avondale Estates and Clarkston and on, when you start having these restrictions crop up, each one wants to push them further out than the other. And the city that doesn't do that, they perceive that they're going to have an influx. I mean, if you do it in Clarkston and you don't do it in Decatur, two towns close by, well, all the sex offenders will go to Decatur. can't live in Clarkston, what else would you expect them to do? So Decatur says, well, we don't want any more here.
But and when does it eventually hit some sort of critical mass where someone goes, this is untenable, they have to live somewhere, what do we do?
Well, that's what I say we do. We do our best to make it a priority to pass preemption so that you don't have the ever-escalating requirements. And then you try to go address the existing requirements from a policy perspective that they're not effective and it's bad public policy. That's a more tough sell because you're dealing with emotions of humans and humans feel like it makes them safer even though it doesn't.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. And if they're at like city council meetings and they're, you know, down there with pitchforks and flaming torches, I have to think that the city council people are just going to cave under those conditions. None of them are going to stand up and go, settle down, folks. The evidence says that if we do this, it actually makes everyone less safe. I mean, they're going to get voted out. They're going to get booed out. They're going to get tomatoes thrown at them. It's not going to go well.
Not going to go well. And when you start talking about the greater good, Clarkston doesn't care about Decatur. They care about getting them out of their territory.
Right.
And if we can make 95% of Clarkston off limits, who cares about Decatur? That's not our problem.
Right.
You have to start thinking about the greater good. And I had a very conservative person just in the last couple of weeks talking to me about the greater good. I said, now you're starting to sound like a liberal when you're talking about the greater good. I said, I thought we were in it for what's good for the individual. And we're all about individualism. Now you're starting to start talking about public policy based on what is the greater good. But clearly society would be a greater good if we didn't have offenders on a registry, period. If we didn't have offenders on a registry that go underground because of these ridiculous, I mean, they kind of defeat their own beliefs. If the registry works, which I don't believe it does, but if it did, how could it work if the restrictions drive it to where you can't comply? If they drive non-compliance rates up, how could it work if it ever did work?
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt, no doubt. I'm looking at the next article and I find it terribly interesting that, so the next one comes from WKRN. And it says, Giles County Sheriff says, sex offenders move to Tennessee for lax laws. And I just say that, and I'm tickled by it because of the next article about Tennessee kicking people out of their homes. But so here's the sheriff that says that sex offenders are crossing the Alabama border to move to Tennessee because Tennessee has more lax laws than Alabama. And I guess we've covered a bunch of times about state shopping, and you'd be crazy if you didn't state shop. And the organizations that we're a part of, they won't go out and publicly say this state is better than that state just because there would be a whole ton of backlash and people would get messed up for living in those states. They would call them out, I guess you could say. But I just kind of find it kind of coincidental and ironic that this article shows up here too.
Well, it's good timing because the listener, I don't know if he's a patron, but one of our listeners from Pennsylvania that had written to us asking about Florida, Pennsylvania, he took it as though I was saying that he was state shopping. I have no idea who's state shopping. I'm not in a position to know. All I know is that people do state shop. And my personal opinion is you would be, I hate to say crazy, but you would be remiss if you didn't state shop. If you have the option and circumstances will allow you to live in other states where you can have a better life, why would you choose a more harsh life in state A versus state B? I can't imagine anybody in their right mind would. So this is an example of where people have gone from Alabama to Tennessee and they've told the registry officials, I've moved here because I can't have my kids. I can't be in the home with my kids in Alabama. That's what I caution against. If you do move to a state from another state, when you go into register, when they say, why did you come here? Never say it's because your laws are better. Because that gets documented and that gets compiled into a spreadsheet where they say when they go to the Capitol and the sex offender registration apparatus asks for the laws to be changed, they use those numbers. They say we've had 47 people move here in the last year that said they moved here because our state is more lax. So please don't do that for your own good. When they ask you why you moved here, say, I'm not sure. I have to have a reason for moving here. That's one answer. Another answer is I moved here because I like this state.
Yes, better schools, something.
don't tell them because the registry restrictions are more lenient. So that was my point. And this comes in as a good time to you know, the the Pennsylvania issue, I think was where he had no connection whatsoever to Florida, but just happened to have a criminal charge there, and then he's hounded by a regulatory scheme that Pennsylvania says, based on your Florida conviction, you have to register by their requirements, and they have the option of incorporating that into their law, and they can do it until they're stopped. If I were in that position, I would consider a challenge saying, well, I think it's an equal protection issue. There's no assurance that that's going to work. But clearly, if you have an equivalent state offense and you would have to register for 10 years and you have a out-of-state offense and it's truly a regulatory scheme, that would, to me, would seem like an equal protection issue that could at least be explored, because what would happen if you brought your car to Pennsylvania? They said, well, Florida used to charge you $274 a year for that. In our state, it normally be $85 a year, but we're going to charge you the $284 that Florida charges. I think that would clearly go as an equal protection. So I don't understand why this regulatory scheme, why that would not be a credible case to make. I can't guarantee it'll work, but I can guarantee it won't if you don't. And I can guarantee you they're not going to change it on their volition.
Right.
To release you from the length of obligation.
I just think it's kind of funny that this guy is just coming out. It almost seems like he's trolling to get his the people living in his county to rise up and thanks for keeping us safe and bringing this to our awareness and all this stuff. Just making stink just to stir shit.
Of course, that's what he's doing. That's why we have to get this regulatory scheme out of the hands of law enforcement. There are not any regulatory schemes that I can think of where you have to register with people that have guns and tasers, and you have to go behind locked doors oftentimes to do that. And I think this one should be removed from law enforcement. There's absolutely no reason why this can't be handled without you having to be involved with law enforcement. So that's my goal, is if we can't kill it, we move it out of the hands of law enforcement.
Can you, I'm sure I've asked you this before, what does that look like going forward? That looks like you go to the DMV and you just do it, or, and it's just a normal sort of paperwork process, just like renewing your driver's license, and there shouldn't be a whole lot of stress involved?
That would be my vision. Now, this is not a vision of a registry I'd like to have, but as I say on this podcast, if I have an opportunity to make life better for people, I'm going to seize the opportunity, because it's all about improving the quality of life for people. So those of you who dream of pie in the sky and the silver bullet that's going to end the registry, you can keep dreaming. But in the meantime, I'm going to try to do everything I can to make life more livable. So if we could take the registry as it exists today, and since it's a civil regulatory scheme, if we could move it to that would be the logical place, because they're set up for all the things that need to be done. When you deal with a motor vehicle office, you're dealing with people who know how to keep a database. They know how to take photographs. They know how to take fingerprints for commercial driving driver's license applications. And they know how to send out notices of renewal. They do it all the time for millions of people with their license plates and with their driver's licenses. So since it's civil regulatory, you would go in and periodically, just like you do to update your driver's license, and you would update. And you would do the same thing with motor vehicles. You can go online and do a lot, like most states require within 30 days that you technically are supposed to notify them that you've changed your address to re-register your car to the correct address and have your driver's license, even though it may say the old address on your license, that it be in the computer correctly. And they provide you the opportunity to update that online. Well, you would do the same thing for this civil regulatory scheme. If a person has any information that changes, they would merely go online and update the registry. There's no reason for guns to be coming out. There's no reason to be dealing with a person. To keep this database, there's absolutely no reason that requires law enforcement. So that's why we have to get it. Then we wouldn't have grandstanding sheriffs like Giles County, Tennessee, and all over the country. I'm not going to single them out. They do it all over the country. We wouldn't have that.
I think we talked about, like, you know, you have enough technology in your pocket that you could take a picture of yourself and upload it to the DMV website, and they could approve it. You would actually never have to step foot in the place to do your registration. You can do a driver's license for 10 years in Georgia. So why does this have to be where it is?
Well, I'm going to talk out of my area of qualifications. I had a discussion with them the last time I had my photo made, and you had to take your glasses off, and they
Right,
said
right.
that the photo does certain biometric, I think the word they use, measurements, and it can't do those with your glasses on. So I don't know if a cell phone selfie would be sufficient to do all the biometrics that they want in their photographs, so they can do the photo match, where they can use their millions of, they can run a photo through their millions and get a hit, or at least a near miss. So, but clearly, your photo that you don't change that much over a 3 month period. There's no need for a photo every 3 months. There's no need for a photo, in my opinion, any more frequently than what the state requires for your driver's license. So if you can go 8 years without updating your photo and your driver's license, I think that would be an appropriate interval. Certainly half that would be no more than half that would be enough. More than every 4 years. I think in New York, we've got a listener here, but I think in New York, in fact, I think you only have to update your photo every 3 years in the New York registry.
Do you think it has anything to do with something like facial hair and haircuts, just so that they have that really that on the point kind of picture of you?
Well, that's their excuse. They say that these sex offenders are very devious and they try to conceal their identity. But you can do that. You can do that. And facial hair doesn't take that long to grow. So you could go in with a completely shaven face and you can have facial hair within a week or 10 days later.
Right, or
So,
inverse. Yep. Go in there with a full beard and then shave it off the next day.
if that's the reason, then that's hocus pocus. Then you might as well just have a continuous photograph.
Yes.
Every day when you get up, you have to do a live stream to the sex offender office.
Charles
So,
says only level 2 picks every 2 years and level 3 every year.
level 3, of course, that's a risk-based system in New York. So I thought it was not very frequent to have to go in. So every 3 years, did he say?
Every 2 years for level 2 and level 3 is every year.
What about level 1? Any information on level
He
1?
didn't say. Well, all right then. Do you want to do the Scalia clip now? Are
Oh,
you prepared
that's
for that?
great. We missed him last week, so we want to continue our famous music, along with hearing a little bit of Scalia on the law.
Very good. Here we go with some Antonin Scalia.
But that there are these broad guarantees in the Bill of Rights, like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, equal protection of the law, that the application has to evolve over time, and that otherwise the Constitution cannot fit the modern age.
Yeah, it doesn't have to evolve over time. If it was up to the courts to make it evolve over time, there would not have been a provision for amendment. It contains a provision of amendment precisely because the framers understood that they may find some provisions in the future are not good and additional provisions are needed. Look, what the Constitution does, those provisions especially that guarantee individual rights, it takes certain matters out of the background rule of democracy, which is the majority rules. Now, there are exceptions to that, and most of them are in the Bill of Rights. The majority won't rule about speech, about religion, about quartering troops in homes, and so forth. Every one of those things is taken out of democratic self-government. And whenever you leave it up to the courts to read in a new exception, you're leaving it up to the courts to limit the scope of self-government. So, it is not that I think the Constitution cannot be applied to new phenomena, such as television, such as telephones, as far as free speech is concerned. Of course it can. You have to figure out how those principles apply to new phenomena. But as to the phenomena that existed at the time, this is what originalism consists of. With respect to those phenomena, it doesn't change.
So that's why you would say, with the death penalty, which you've said often, that because it existed at the time of the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment, the fact they didn't mention it means.
Well, it isn't just they didn't mention, they said cruel and unusual punishments. But nobody at the time believed that that proscribed the death penalty, because every state had it, and every state continued to have it for several centuries. Now, it may be a very bad idea, in which case, pass a law. You don't need the Constitution to get rid of it.
I have a question for you. He brings that up a lot, where he says every state. There were 13, maybe 16 or 17 states at the times that he's talking about. It's not, we have a whole lot more states. There's what, 57 states now?
Something like that, somewhere in the 50s.
Doesn't that change somewhat of the dynamic of him saying all of the states when you're only talking about a dozen-ish versus 50?
Well, but throughout American history, the majority of the states have had a death penalty, and I think they still do have majority have a death penalty. So what the point he's making is that the framers representing those states had no intention of prohibiting the death penalty. They did not when they were dreaming up cruel and unusual punishment. It never entered their mind that there was anything cruel or unusual about the death penalty since it was widely used in colonial America. So that's his point he's making. Therefore, you can't evolve the death penalty out by an evolving standard of decency. You have to do it by law, which is what we did in 2009 in my state. We repealed the death penalty and replaced it with life in prison without parole. And he's saying that that's one of those things that the example of the Constitution doesn't evolve to change what was a given at the time. But you can change it. That's why you have the amendment process. And if it doesn't require an amendment, you can change the law. So I just want people to understand that he's big on democratic society has a responsibility to self-govern. And don't get mad at the courts when you govern in a way that you end up the things where the majority have to say so. Don't expect the courts to save you from the will of the majority unless they have trampled the Constitution. And he takes a very narrow view of what it takes to trample the Constitution. There's no such thing as far as he's concerned as any right to be free from execution. As long as you get due process, you can be deprived of life, liberty, or property with due process of law.
And when you say narrow, could you describe what you mean by narrow?
He doesn't believe that it's the judge's role to decide what's good for society. What's in the best interest of society is not for the court to determine. That's for the people as they self-govern, as they govern themselves to figure out what's the best public policies. He is only there to guard the Constitution, and the Constitution as the framers intended to what the limitations were that they intended. And he doesn't believe that it evolved to include a whole bunch of stuff, including abortion. He doesn't believe there's any right to an abortion in the Constitution.
But it also, I don't think he's taken the stance that there is a prohibition of it either, it seems.
Absolutely. He takes the stand that any state's free to prohibit abortion.
Right.
He takes the stand that they have, since there's no right for abortion, that there's a right to prohibit abortion. But the Supreme Court said in 1973 there is such a right, at least during the first trimester. And that's under attack now. There's a lot of states that are passing laws. I think the heartbeat is that
yes.
One state passed a heartbeat detection, and then another state passed there's a handful of states that are hoping that they can position something before the court because they want to find out. The only way we will know how far they can go to limit abortion is to keep chipping away and passing laws that are presumed constitutional until a challenging party shows that they're not. So they're determined to get more cases dealing with abortion before the Supreme Court. Same thing with gun control. There is no absolute right to own weapons, to own any type of weapon. But and Judge Scalia has said that, and we'll play that clip at some point in the future. I have it in the inventory, but we'll play that. But where that boundary is yet to be determined. The right case has to make it to the court.
Yeah, on that particular point, like it's clear. You don't have people driving to the local convenience store in a tank loaded with, 155 millimeter or inch round, big massive artillery going to the convenience store.
Absolutely. But the courts will draw the boundaries as the cases work their way through the system, through the appellate courts and get to the Supreme Court. And they decide, four justices decide to grant a review, grant cert as it's called. Then we'll find out. And some of these abortion laws, they're being enjoined from enforcement right away, and of course the proponents of these laws will try their best to get these issues before the court because they believe the court's more favorably disposed to impose more limitations than what there were in Roe v. Wade.
Interesting.
And
interesting.
Of course, that's drifted way off topic here. But.
No, I totally get it. I totally get it. But we're talking about his mindset and of what would be considered constitutional or not. That's I just want to try and. As I think about these things in my own thought process develops that we are covering and trying to dig into those issues more.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Well, I guess that kind of leads us down to this whole Tennessee thing, right?
It does lead us to Tennessee.
Have you heard about this thing in Tennessee going on?
I have heard about it. It's all over the news.
It kind of blew up Twitter and also our Discord server. Do you want to give us the 10-second version of what goes on with Senate Bill 425?
Well, that's what I composed your questions for.
Don't tell people that I have scripted questions.
Well, you normally don't. But what had happened was, for the listeners, we had an attorney that was going to be here today with us. And as my style, I don't do ambush questions. I do provide questions in advance. I provide them for the purpose of getting precise answers and making sure that they're prepared to answer what I'd like to know, what I think would help the listening audience. So therefore, I had prepared the questions written as if we were going to have the attorney. About 2 hours before recording time, he informed me that one or two of his colleagues decided that this would be treading in the area of ethical a violation of ethics in Tennessee for them to comment public on this case right now. So therefore, he asked to drop out, and therefore I would prefer that the questions that I was intended to ask him, that I'll do my best to answer those.
Sure.
So what we were intended to do is we want to illuminate the nuances of the statute. We want to talk about the importance of plaintiff selection and the presumption of constitutionality of legislative enactments, and the robust defense that the state of Tennessee is likely to mount, and the complexity of litigating a class action. That's what the overall scope of the interview that I planned. And then you have to listen to me rather than a brilliant and a very, very well qualified attorney. And I'm sorry that he felt, and I think I agree with him, that it's probably the right thing to do at this precarious posture. So what we have right now procedurally is that the temporary restraining order has been granted, and therefore the state is not free to enforce this at all on July 1st, as they would have been. And then the court is going to have a hearing on the 11th of July for what's called a preliminary injunction. And so the TRO, as it's called, is in effect right now. That was issued yesterday. And then there's a hearing on the 11th. And if anything were to blow up on them, that TRO could be dissolved. So it's a sensitive time in litigation. So we're waiting to see if the preliminary injunction is going to be issued on the matter on the 11th. Now, the preliminary injunction is not final. The case still has to go to trial. Cases are only resolved by either settlements or going to trial. So the preliminary injunction would cover until the case were to proceed to trial or to be settled. And that's what's the status in Rhode Island right now. There was the same exact thing happened when they were going to evict the offenders from their homes by expanding the residency restriction from 300 to 1,000 feet. There was a temporary restraining order issued, and the state, I believe, stipulated, to my surprise, to the entry of a preliminary injunction. Or at least they did not oppose the issuance of the injunction. And then the case has not proceeded to trial because the state has been fighting tooth and nail and not cooperating in the discovery process. And then they amended the statute, which convoluted issues that had to be further developed. So that case is just sitting there, but everyone's protected. So we've got protection in Tennessee right now through the 11th. I would like to hope that based on what has already been filed and pled, that's going to continue beyond the 11th, that they'll become a preliminary injunction. And then the case would be set towards trial or towards settlement. And then the whatever settlement, if there were to be a settlement, of course, would include what would be called a permanent injunction against enforcement. I can't imagine they would settle this without a permanent injunction. So a settlement would include a permanent injunction.
To fill in a gap of what I understand, I think there are three plaintiffs, and wouldn't the injunction only apply to them?
Well, that would be technically correct. But the motion is for it's a class action complaint. It hasn't been certified yet as a class action, but the request for the injunctive relief is for an injunction for everybody to join the state of Tennessee from enforcing this act. So it would apply to everybody. This normally when you have a plaintiff, the action is to the plaintiff, but this has been filed as a class action, and the judge has granted the TRO to apply to everybody. Tennessee is frozen in place to the status quo, at least until the 11th.
Okay. Is it hard to get what's the legal standard for obtaining injunctive relief?
Oh, it's a very, very high one. And this is one of the things where it would really help for our people to understand. Not liking a law is not enough to get an injunction. That would be fantastic if that were the standard. But the standard is a very, very, very high one, because the collective wisdom of the lawmakers in Tennessee. Now, let's just be clear. This was not something that snuck up on people and passed in the middle of the night with no debate. This was something that was introduced, I believe, on January 31st. There was a bill introduced in the House, and unlike an identical bill introduced in the Senate. The Senate bill, which was the one that ultimately passed both chambers, but it went through the committee processes. It passed unanimously in the Senate, and it passed unanimously in the House. So the collective wisdom of all the residents of Tennessee is that this is good public policy. So the courts they begin by assuming that it is constitutional. The presumption is a legislative enactment is constitutional. So to nullify the will of the people and to stop the will of the people from becoming operational, the standard is horrendous. They have to show that through their initial pleadings that this case is likely to prevail on the merits, that the plaintiffs are going to prevail on the merits when and if it does go to trial, and that they will suffer irreparable harm without the injunction. Now, the International Megan's Law is one that comes to mind where people were disappointed. Well, the standard for an injunction is almost impossible to meet, and that's why they could not meet that standard, because in Tennessee, we've got an exact act that's going into effect on Monday without an injunction. Sheriff's departments have already been advising people in the preceding month. This was signed on May 10th, become effective July 1st. The sheriff's departments, amazingly as short-staffed as they are, have been advising offenders, and the probation and the supervision authorities have been advising people that they have to get out of their homes by July 1st. And so we have certainty of what's going to happen. But with the International Megan's Law, we did not have certainty of what was going to happen. We had a congressional action that was totally unclear what was going to happen. There was going to be a marking on the driver's licenses. We didn't know what the marking was going to look like. We didn't know if it was going to have big red letters, if it was going to be a sexual offender, if it was going to be a little code that says AF127. We had no idea what it was going to be looking like, and how people were going to be contrasting what you have in Tennessee. You have a family where you're being told as of Monday, you can't be with your daughter. On International Megan's Law, you may or not ever travel. And the International Megan's Law didn't say that you couldn't travel. It said that if you did travel, that you needed to give 21 days advance notice, and that you would have some kind of special marking. So here we have the exact act spelled out what's going to happen, which is eviction and separation of families. Gee, that's a familiar thing. We hear about that in other aspects of our daily lives, don't we? We know that separation of families was going to happen. and we assume that if you're separated from your family, unless we can invent a time machine, we do not know how to get that time back. That bonding time, that nurturing time, and the support. I mean, if you have to maintain a separate household, I would dare say you're going to incur some additional cost.
Certainly.
So we can see. We can see the irreparable harm, but we can't get the time back. It's going to be costly. So therefore, you have the basic two elements. There's actually a couple more, but the primary two are that you have to show that you're likely to succeed on the merits when you go to trial, and that you would suffer irreparable harm without the injunction. We didn't have the ability to meet that standard with International Megan's Law. We did not have the ability to meet that. That's why it wasn't granted by two different federal judges. It's a very high burden. And these lawyers have picked, there's a team of four, and who knows, there may be other cases we don't know about, but in the case we know about that we're talking about on the injunction, there's four different attorneys, and one of them is just supremely qualified with his credentials to be doing this type of work, the one that was going to be on the show with us. And they've put together a very compelling case with very good plaintiffs that are very attractive in terms of the case that they've made.
Is it hard? How do I want to word this? Is there's something to be said about filling the courtroom with a whole bunch of people? Is there something that having spectators there, is that good for us?
It's a natural tendency to want to do that. My son's going to court today. By golly, I'm going to show up and show support. I'm going to be there for his support. Well, I always tell people, and what we're doing here, it's not advisable unless the legal team wants it, and always consult with the legal team because they know the nuances of those judges. They know the nuances of the lay of the land. But just on an intellectual basis, we seem to get angry when courts impose sentences based on mob rules. There's an angry chant in the courtroom and someone gets 5 years in prison when they could have gotten probation, but for that angry chant. We would be irritated to no end if that happened. We would say, well, the judge is supposed to go by the law and the facts of the case, and it's not supposed to respond to an angry mob. Well, why doesn't that work in reverse? If we show up with an angry mob there, why would we want the court to rule based on an angry mob? If the court can remove, if we don't want to give him mob justice, we should not try to intimidate the court into ruling our way. So I tell people, show up only if you're invited. I mean, you have the right, the courts are open. So if you want to go through the metal detectors and through the screening that they do in a federal courthouse, you certainly have the right to go if they have seating. But don't go planning to chant and protest and have outbursts in the courtroom. That's not going to be helpful to the cause.
Plus, it might
get you thrown in jail.
who provides the defense for this class action?
Well, as a general rule, and it's specifically in the case of Tennessee, it'll be the Attorney General's office. So they will be, and in fact, they have been clear to announce that they have already become aware of the litigation, and they have already entered an appearance to the court. Now, it would help for people to understand, when you file for a temporary restraining order, that is an ex parte communication with the judge. They went in just a couple of days ago asking for this TRO, and without hearing from the other side, that's why they're called temporary restraining orders, because just on the compelling nature of the pleadings, you're looking at that and say, my goodness, this is so compelling that on the credibility of the legal team, I'm going to grant an emergency request to restrain this from happening pending a hearing where we hear from the parties. So this is just an amazing thing that the attorneys had that much credibility to get a judge to stick his neck out in this case and grant a restraining order over what will be, I can almost assure you, be the vehement objections of Tennessee. When they get to the hearing on the 11th, they're going to have a whole host of reasons why this is sound public policy and there's nothing wrong with it. And they will defend it, which is their job. When they put their hand on their Bible, on that Bible, and take their oath of office, they say that I will defend the laws of the state of Tennessee, and that's exactly what they will do.
Do they have to scale how hard they try too, don't they? I mean, sometimes it'd be like, yeah, we're not going to fight really hard on this one, but then other times they're going to throw down the gauntlet and tooth and nail, and you know, I'm going to die by my sword if you know, to fight this one. Do you think that they would fight this that hard?
I think they probably will fight this, because you got to remember that office is an elected office. I don't know of a state in the country where the attorney general of the state is not elected. There may be one, so I'm not saying there isn't, but I can't think of one. So since it's a politicized office by the very nature of its creation, that you run for attorney general, the will of the people is somewhat in your back of your mind all the time. I mean, you can wish it weren't, and you can say that's not the way it ought to be, and I agree with you, that's not the way it ought to be, but that's the way it is. And so therefore, in the case of like with same-sex marriage, California Attorney General decided they weren't going to defend that action. We're not going to defend the ban on the same. The voters did it, but we're going to let it fall by the wayside. We're not going to defend it. Well, they had a significant amount of public support for that position. I bet the public support in Tennessee for the sex offenders is kind of on the lower part of the scale. What would you bet?
I would be willing to bet that they would happily throw them under the bus when that bus comes knocking.
So I don't think an attorney general can afford to go in and say, well, yeah, this is kind of something where it shouldn't have gone through the legislature. They got it wrong, although it was unanimously. And yeah, I'm supposed to defend it. I'll show up and I'll make a few murmurs of protest, but I don't reckon it'll be too bad that's not likely to be their position.
How hard is it to get class action status?
It can be very hard because the state will fight that as well. And they will fight certification because they don't want it's kind of like the comparison would be on if you have an employment relationship where you have the ability to sue in a group, or if you have to bring your actions collectively. The business industry's communities have been pushing really hard to neuter any rights of you to bring an action collectively, because that's much easier to bring. Well, a class action does the same thing with challenging this criminal law. If the attorney general can succeed in having no certification on the class, that would mean that these four plaintiffs, if they do win, that other people will be suffering the fate of the law, and they'll have to bring their own independent actions. Well, there's 29, I think the attorney said 29,000 sex offenders in the complaint in Tennessee. At least that's the number they gave. Well, what's the chance of 29,000 people being able to know about this, knowing how to secure a representation, and having 29,000 cases pending? Well, the court takes that into consideration also when they grant class action. They take into consideration the commonality of the claims, how similar or identical they are, and the ability of the law firm to represent everyone as a class. And there are all these factors that go into, but just simply stamping on their class action. That's what, if you look at the complaint, which I think we're going to have in the case notice, it says class action complaint for declaratory injunctive relief. But that doesn't make it a class action until the court certifies it. And the state will fight back. I would be utterly amazed if the state just says, oh, sure, make this a class action, Judge. We don't have any objection to that, because they could neutralize the relief by forcing everyone to file their own cause of action. So the state will be vehemently opposed to class certification.
This doesn't apply to 29,000 people. At least my understanding is this is a fairly exclusive set of people with a very young victim. And
you're correct.
So hundreds of people this probably affects.
I would say. Well, you have to have had an offense with someone under 12. And then you're not allowed to live with a minor, even your own. But see, this is the nuance is that I'm not clear if you had a victim under 12, and you didn't have a victim under 12. Well, of course, it would apply to if you picked up a new victim, right? If you picked up another sex offense, you would have a victim if it was under 12. But of the people who had victims under 12, that would be a finite number. But it would be very difficult for us to know, looking in from the outside, how large the 29,000 is that had a victim under 12. But it could be a significant number. I don't think it's going to be just a couple of hundred.
Okay. It would just seem to me that it's, you know, in the low thousands, maybe. But
low thousands.
Yeah.
But if 3,000 people have to bring their own case? Say it's 10% of the registry.
But that was going to be my next question. Is there a minimum standard to do class action? I mean, do 5 people then warrant class action status, or is it 50? Where does that threshold begin?
It has to. I don't think there's a magic number. There has to be a number of people where their claims are almost identical. And everybody's claim would be identical in this. I had a victim under 12. And I'm going to be forced out of my home. So to me, fits the criteria, and judicial economy would be best served. I mean, say it is 3,000. You don't want 3,000 cases bobbing around in the court
on
the same exact issue with 3,000 different discovery process. The AG would be happy with that because they've got the public's money to operate with. They would probably be not happy, but they would be okay with that. But it would be very difficult for the individuals to mount 3,000 causes of action. So I think there's a reasonable chance that they'll get a reasonably good chance they'll be certified. But that doesn't mean the state's not going to fight.
Right.
They're not going to oppose it. I'll be very surprised if they don't oppose it. I mean, we'll watch this as it goes through, but I would be very surprised if they stipulate the class certification. Stipulate means that they agree to it and say that judge, just fine. You can go ahead and certify this as class action.
You have mentioned this to me. I'd never considered this concept before, but you bring up judicial economy. Please tell me what judicial economy means.
Well, kind of like just what it what the word, rather than having each time there's a case open, that's going to have to be assigned to a judge, and it's going to have support staff on the court side and on the state side as well. So rather than having 3,000 cases, wouldn't it be much more economic for the court to have one case where they're doing one process and they're resolving this exact same issue for everyone? So that's what judicial economy means, that rather than having all these.
It's a neat concept that you brought up to me some time ago, talking about a Georgia case and, you know, individual counties and all that stuff. It would gum up the system with just this one thing, but to be able to lump them all into one general concept and push them all through at the same time.
Well, and that's what the class certification would do, is that anybody, unless they opted out, there's a process where if you don't want to be a member of the class, you could usually file notice that you want to be opted out. But I don't know why anyone on the registry would opt out of a free attorney that's gaining traction to say, I would rather pursue my own cause of action. I doubt there'd be any opt-outs, but you can't opt out.
Someone in chat asks, and I don't know if I've read this anywhere, but it says, does it hurt anything if they admit there wasn't much of any research into how this policy would affect people? Does that matter at all?
I can't see how it would hurt anything. When you're making public policy, unless you break the Constitution, you don't need research. Now, if the court decides that you can do this, they could rule that having the entire universe of those who had victims under 12 should not be. But if it were narrowly tailored and targeted toward a certain select group of offenders, maybe it would be constitutional, because, as I've said, you can take life, liberty, and property with due process. So if they were to provide due process, it might be constitutional. But see, if I were on the legal team and they made the argument, I'd say, well, there is already that due process for people. If you're going to narrowly tailor it, it's already narrowly tailored. The family courts already have the child protective services already have authority to investigate homes and to petition family courts for custody of children that are in an unsafe environment. So there's already a mechanism to remove children from the homes of offenders. And I think it's in some cases already overly used, because I hear complaints about, well, they showed up at my house for no reason at all, just because I was on the registry and I had to go through all this laborious investigation and prove that I was a fit parent. But to me, there's already a process for that. So I think they very well could. This could be constitutional in very, very limited circumstances, but I would fight against that. But just because you don't like something doesn't make it unconstitutional if it's sufficiently narrowly tailored. There's a lot of things can be done that are narrowly tailored, including taking away your rights to your children.
And leading up to all this, a particular person in Tennessee was kind of blowing up my my connection. He was chatting with me a lot, saying, "How did this get missed? How come nobody saw this coming? Slipped in under the radar." And I know that you addressed that a little bit before, but that we collectively don't typically have any much of anything in place watching for the terms and to see any of this stuff coming down the pike.
Well, let me just answer that listener's question with a question. You have a legislative website in Tennessee. Every time a bill is introduced, it's listed on the website. Were you watching the website? Because on January 31st of this year, two pieces of legislation, one was filed in the Senate and one was filed in the House. If you weren't watching, that's how the public gets notified. And there's no organization that I know of, whether it be of the three that they advocate primarily for sex offenders, that has the ability to watch all these legislative websites. And then once you're watching it doesn't do any good. Watching is the first step. But this next step would actually been to show up in the Tennessee Capitol when this was moving through the committee process and offer testimony and offer them real live stories of what was going to happen. And that, like, it when you read this complaint, which tells the story of the four plaintiffs about the hardships they would endure, that would have been your opportunity to have that discussion with the policymakers. But there was no one there making that argument. It didn't slip in on the radar. It went through the process over a 5-month period with nobody watching that cared enough about it. I mean, we knew about it toward the tail end of it, but we were powerless at NARSL to do anything about it. The advocacy in Tennessee is very, very much in its beginning stages in terms of how well organized they are, how much experience they have at having somebody who's able to be in the Capitol when this is happening. Mm.
Yeah, I knew that's where you were going to go with it. And one of the main purposes of this podcast is to give the people listening the concept, the idea, the tools so that they can take that first step, watch the website, figure out how to navigate that, just to at least know that this is coming down the pike. Here it is, the end of June. This was definitely in play sometime in January for someone to do something with it, but we're not even present.
Well, there again, like I say, the Tennessee advocacy is in its infancy, but this bill was filed on January 31st. And it was identical one was filed in both chambers. It was House Bill 407 and Senate Bill 425. And it was placed on, heard in the Senate Judiciary Committee in April. Where were you guys when it was heard? You always hear these, well, it passed in the middle of the night. No, it did not pass in the middle of the night with no one watching. It passed in the middle of broad daylight with everyone watching that cared to be watching. And most legislatures, or many of them, I don't know if I could say most, but many of them are live streaming the hearings, the public hearings in committee. They're being live streamed. Now, you don't get to participate by live stream, but you get to hear what's being said. And so this is not a closed process. Now, I did find out from a few years back that Tennessee does have a little more robust process to sign up to be heard in committee. You have to get more permission. In most states where I've worked in legislative, you just simply either show up or show up and sign up on a roster outside the committee hearing door, and then they give you 2 or 3 minutes to say your piece. But folks, your 2 or 3 minutes is not really where the significant impact has had. That has more impact on the victim side when they can fill a room and have people go make 3 minute speeches, and they can just run 2 dozen of those through. That has impact. But on our side, our 2 minute speeches, there's first of all not nearly as many of them usually, and they're not nearly as compelling from the point of view compared to the victims. Where you have more impact is in your private conversation when you develop a relationship with your lawmaker, and your lawmaker tells you, well, actually, I have a friend who's on the registry and this stuff is all wrong. And then you start having a conversation with how you can provide that lawmaker some political cover for some steps you'd like to see taken. And you can actually do a whole lot more in private. But now public is not, I'm not saying it's not important. It is important to go to these hearings. It is important to speak up. But that's one part of the equation. It's just like watching the website. Watching the website by itself doesn't do anything other than informs you of the train that's about to run over you. And showing and testifying in committee is an important step. But forming relationships where you can actually be heard privately is also very important. And forming relationships with analysts where you can actually get important information to analysts who don't know this issue so that they can get those points in analyst committee reports. There's so many things. This is... The sausage is made in ways that most people don't understand because that's not what they do.
Sure.
And all these things are part of the puzzle. There's no silver bullet.
Is there anything else that you want to cover about this before we let it go?
Well, I'm looking forward to speaking for NARSL. We've been approached by the legal team. We've heard their concerns, and we share their concerns. And we give kudos to what they've done so far. And we're waiting for them to have a specific request to us of what we can do to be helpful. They've already had one request, which is money. And that's something we have a small amount of. And we very judiciously hand that money out to attorneys. But they've got 4 attorneys working on this case. 3 of them are in small firms. One of them is in a solo practice. 2 of them are in 3-person firms, and then 1 of them is in a larger firm where there's multiple attorneys. If the state fights back, as I expect them to do, you can look at Nebraska, you can look at Michigan, where the attorney's fees ran well over $1 million that they fought for a long time. If you look at Maryland, if you just look around the country, the likelihood is that they will be at this for some time before this is resolved. So we're hoping to be able to come to an agreement to provide them resources, financial and expertise. Otherwise, we've provided them some news about stories that we'd accumulated about this, including the Alabama one that you just put on there. I don't think they were aware of that, but about the sheriff saying that the Alabama offenders were coming up to Giles County Sheriff. But we are doing our best to be helpful to them. It may turn into a fundraising opportunity. Yeah, if this is going to be prolonged litigation, it's going to be very costly. We may be asking the people in Tennessee to step up, and even from around the country. This is not just a Tennessee problem. So I would say to you and the rest of the country, just remember that the international Megan's Law marking started not by international, by passports. It started by states who were marking driver's licenses, and it barely caught a whimper of attention when states were putting overt marks on driver's licenses. And first thing you know, we end up with passport marking. Well, the same thing happening here. We've got this encroachment of restrictions on people living with their families. And there's, I think, 13 states, I'm told, that have some sort of restriction. Alabama and Tennessee have this similar restriction about you can't live with any minor. Some have it where 13 states have it where you can't live it if your child was a victim of your crime until all these things happen that you never have happened where you can finally get permission. So this is one of those things where if we don't take a strong stand now, even though you don't live in Tennessee, and even though you can sit there and say, well, I'm in Idaho, we don't have that here. Whatever's happening in any state has the potential to happen in your state, and never lose sight of that. So we may end up fighting, taking as strong a stand as we can in Tennessee to prevent this from spreading, kind of like the stand that we're trying to take in Rhode Island to prevent the retroactive increase of residence restrictions from becoming something that becomes the norm. We want the Tennessee Assembly to understand you can't do this, and we want any other assembly that contemplates it to know that you can't do this. If you do this, there's a bunch of people going to come in from outside your state, and we're going to be right in your throat and in your face.
Well, considering how depressing this is, I do feel highly more motivated and inspired by what the things that you've just said about getting involved and helping the other states and being aware and being active. I think it's really enlightening.
So it's very important to never think you're in an isolated oasis when you have this type of conviction, that just because your state doesn't have something that it can't. I mean, Tennessee didn't think they were going to have it until they did.
Well, I think we should wrap it up before I get in a whole lot of trouble. We do have a bit of an announcement that I will turn it over to you to make.
Well, we have some sad news about one of our patrons, Laura, who's been with us since day one. She's hospitalized now, and don't know all the details, don't really know many of the details other than being in contact with her cell phone, that family member reached out to us and said that she's in the hospital. So asking for support and prayer.
It's very sad. Yes. And she's been with us for a very long time. Yep. And so our thoughts go out to Laura and hope she has a speedy recovery.
Hopefully we'll know more and it'll be good news on the next podcast that she is recovering. But right now it's very bleak from what I was told.
Very sad. Well, on that, Larry, I would request that people visit the website registrymatters.co and reach out to us at 747-227-4477 if you want to leave a voicemail message, and registrymatterscast@gmail.com if you want to send an email message, and support the podcast over at patreon.com/registrymatters. And on that, that's all I have, Larry, and I wish you a very good night.
Thanks, Andy, for taking time out of your vacation with your family time to do this important episode. We had planned on skipping, but with the news in Tennessee and with the importance of this, we wanted to reach our people with as much information as we could. So thank you for being
absolutely
honest.
I wouldn't miss it. And with that, thanks everybody hanging out, and I will talk to you soon, Larry. Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.